Welcome to the 300 to 350 show, a syndicated community radio program that's following our rocky journey to climate safety. The UN climate talks resume in Poznan, Poland in a couple of weeks' time, part of an ongoing process which will culminate in Copenhagen in 2009, in what author Ian McEwan is described as one of the most important international meetings ever convened. In yesterday's Guardian newspaper, he goes on to note that if it does not result in practical, radical measures, the fight to control our future could well be lost. Climate activists are already talking about shutting down or locking in the negotiators in Copenhagen if they fail to come up with a full and total solution to the problem. The talks to date have been following the framework of the current Kyoto Protocol, which has clearly failed as global greenhouse gas emissions continue to rise. And indeed, greenhouse gas emissions are rising at a faster rate than ever before, faster even than any of the scenarios used by the UN's climate science body, the IPCC. Perhaps the best thing that could come out of the meetings is for negotiators to start thinking outside of the box and to consider some of the alternative proposals that exist. Over the next few weeks on this programme, we'll be considering some of those alternatives. Contraction and convergence is the main proposal that has been around since the 1990s, which improves on the Kyoto framework by allocating emissions targets, not on the basis of political horse trading by individual countries for periods that only last for a few years, but by a scientifically informed global cap on emissions that reduces year by year until each country has an equal right per head of its population to emit greenhouse gases at a level that is considered sustainable. This week we're going to take a look at a relatively new proposal that claims to be an improvement on contraction and convergence that goes under the somewhat audacious name Kyoto 2. Kyoto 2 has been picking up support and interest from such influential people as George Monbiot, Mark Lynas, Jonathan Porritt and Bill McKibben. I spoke to Oliver Tickell, the architect of this new proposal, and started by asking him to identify some of the key problems with the current Kyoto Protocol framework.
The current Kyoto regime doesn't seem to be working. Greenhouse gases are rising at a faster rate than ever, and faster than any of the IPCC scenarios predicted. Can you just give a few main points about why Kyoto isn't working?
Well, I think that you made the point there. Just as we were meant to be seeing greenhouse gas emissions going down, they have actually gone up, and they've gone up at an increasing rate. And so it has failed from the simple point of view of effectiveness. Now, why has it not been effective? First, you could say that the targets that were set for developing country emissions cuts were simply not ambitious enough. We have to add to that that a number of countries have simply failed altogether to meet their targets, such as the United States and most notably now Canada, which, although it has signed up, is actually way ahead of what it should be emitting. So another source of failure is that our objective has to be a global limit on emissions, but you can't get a global limit on emissions by only limiting the emissions of particular countries. And especially when, as we see now, the biggest growth in greenhouse gas emissions has actually come from the rapidly industrializing countries, such as India and China and Mexico and Brazil, for example. So we need, ultimately, some kind of a global system that encompasses all greenhouse gas emissions, not just those from developed countries. To go more deeply into the actual structure of the Kyoto Protocol, I think it begins with a grave disadvantage, which is that it allocates emissions rights and emissions reductions targets on a per-country basis. But in the globalized economy that we have, that simply doesn't make very much sense. The particular point of what chimney does carbon dioxide come out of and what country is that chimney in doesn't come anywhere near reflecting the complexity of international trade in which energy is produced in one country, exported to another, the fuel is burnt there, but then the products that are being made are exported to a third country, and meanwhile the profits might be being made in a fourth country.
So, for example, I mean, we don't really have much of a manufacturing base here now, but we do still consume a lot of manufactured goods, but they're made elsewhere, and the Kyoto method of accounting wouldn't actually allocate those emissions to us, even though we're consuming them
exactly
and responsible for them, in a sense.
That is exactly right. If you have a factory in China which is producing goods for export to Britain, those emissions under the Kyoto system belong to China, when in fact equity might suggest that they belong to us. But then equally, you should say that if the coal is coming from Indonesia or Australia, say, that is powering this factory, maybe they should have their share of responsibility. So how do you do it? The Kyoto 2 solution is to get away from the entire system of country targets and country allocations and simply to go upstream and to regulate greenhouse gases at the level of the fossil fuels as they enter into the economy. And then the price signal follows the fossil fuel because you're levying a cost at source, and then that cost simply perpetuates through the supply chain and is ultimately paid by the consuming country. So that actually avoids the need for a new and complex layer of carbon accounting. And it also removes one of the main sources of disagreement, one of the main obstacles in climate negotiations, which is countries may be agreeing in the abstract that we need to cut emissions quite hard, but at the same time arguing for a national interest of retaining their own country's emission rights and not having targets which they would see as creating a competitive disadvantage. So in this way, you also create a level global playing field and remove that source of dissent from climate negotiations.
Just a few other things about Kyoto before we move on to your proposal. Shipping and aviation aren't included still in Kyoto currently.
That's true. And if you control the production of greenhouse gases at source, that is, at the source of fossil fuels, then the emissions from shipping and aviation are automatically brought in.
And we also have all these flexible measures which basically seem to have been insisted on by the US back in 1997 as a kind of condition for their agreement to signing up to Kyoto, which then, of course, they didn't sign up. And these appear to be generating a lot of fake credits that aren't actually reducing emissions. There's been several reports now. And also creating a kind of massive loophole for rich countries to not actually decarbonise at home.
The flexibility mechanisms have emerged really as a great failure. From one point of view, of course, they've been a great success. You have now a multi-billion dollar carbon trading system going on, and some people think that this makes it a good thing in itself. But very little of the money being traded in carbon markets actually gets through to generating solutions. And my own guess is that probably under a tenth of the value of certified emissions reductions, for example, generated under the Clean Development Mechanism, actually goes through into real additional investments to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Roughly half of all the CERs produced have been produced off the back of an investment in reducing the emissions of a powerful industrial gas called HFC-23. And for an investment of about $100 million, CERs to the value of $4.7 billion have been produced.
Carbon credits.
Carbon credits. And so what we see there is that a minute percentage of the value of what's been produced in the market has actually gone into producing a solution. And I think that this indicates that there are certain aspects of emissions reductions that are actually best handled completely outside of any market mechanism. And we can look there at the Montreal Protocol, which was very effective at reducing emissions of the chlorofluorocarbon gases used in refrigeration and aerosol cans and so on, which damaged the ozone layer. Now, under that model, we would simply pay the technology costs of developing countries, that $100 million that it costs to actually abate these emissions. And that would be the cost instead of a $4.7 billion cost. And one of the great ironies of all of this is that the whole rationale for the Clean Development Mechanism and other flexibility mechanisms was it was meant to be more efficient by allowing emissions reductions to be made where it could be done most cheaply. But what we actually see is the most remarkable inefficiency, in which pretty paltry gains, and often very questionable gains in terms of additionality, have been made at a very high cost.
The other big example is the hydropower projects, which represents about a quarter of CDM projects, I think.
The hydropower projects, and especially in China, have been examined closely in a report by International Rivers. And their conclusion is, as I recall, that 96% of the hydropower carbon credits from China relate to projects which were going to happen anyway.
Right, so there's no additionality there at all, there's no additional carbon savings.
No additionality at all. And it means, in effect, that the carbon markets are awash with fraudulent securities, somewhat akin, actually, to the kind of securities that have rocked the entire financial market, the kind of toxic waste that has triggered the entire credit crunch. And what we want to avoid is a situation where, similarly, fraudulent carbon instruments traded in the carbon market actually play a role in undermining both the climate itself, but also the prospects for effective agreement.
Do you think the current Kyoto process can be reformed, or does it actually need to be completely rethought?
There are certainly people who say, well, this is the best we've got, it's taken us this long to get this far, and our best bet is to stick with it. I take another view, which is that the Kyoto Agreement is actually so flawed, right down to the fundamentals of its design, that it would actually be madness to pursue this model, which is completely ineffective and appears really to be beyond reform. And we would be much better off basing progress in Poznan and later on in Copenhagen on agreements which have worked. And I think that probably the best example for that comes from the Montreal Protocol, which has done far more to reduce greenhouse gas emissions purely by accident as a side effect of cutting down on the ozone-eating gases. It has done much more to deal with global warming than the Kyoto Protocol itself.
The main alternative proposal up until now has been contraction and convergence, which seems to have gained quite a lot of momentum and support, and there's been a campaign for that for quite a while. But you've kind of thrown another whole suggestion down, and I'm wondering if you could just outline how it works in the kind of simplest possible terms, so then we can look at it in a bit more detail.
Well, first, as I explained before, you get away from the entire country system and you control greenhouse gas emissions at source, and that means most of it at the source of the fossil fuels themselves on a global basis. One thing it has in common with contraction and convergence is that you define a global cap, but instead of essentially giving away permits to the governments of the world's countries, you sell these permits, and they have to be surrendered by the companies producing fossil fuels and also those producing other greenhouse gases in a concentrated industrial way. They have to surrender permits based on the contribution that their fuels and other gases are making to emissions. And so you sell these permits, you do it through an auction process, and that limits the volume of emissions that can actually take place in any given time period. And at the same time, you're taking in a substantial amount of money, and a fairly simple back-of-envelope calculation indicates that you could be taking in about $1,000 billion per year, and that is money that you can then spend on delivering solutions to the problems of climate change. And that would include funding the adaptation costs of developing countries. It would include bringing about a renewable energy revolution worldwide by investing in research, development, and very large-scale deployment in developing countries to bring about that renewable energy revolution, and at the same time reduce demand for fossil fuels. And that is important, that you're not just relying on a price signal on its own, which in order to be effective would need to be very high and quite painful. You're bringing down your emissions through the price signal on the one hand, but also through investments in changing the entire way the global energy economy works and therefore reducing demand for fossil fuels so that the carbon price never has to go terribly high. And then there is a third component, which is that you are regulating in order to overcome both market failures and areas where a market is simply not an efficient process. So I think that regulation would apply, for example, to the powerful industrial greenhouse gases where good alternatives exist, because the cost of having a market-driven approach would simply exceed the benefits, and you're better off simply having a ban, rather like we had under the Montreal Protocol. Another major area is energy efficiency, and a recent study by McKinsey consultants showed that there are enormous gains that can be made, and especially here in the developed country economies, in energy efficiency, and that applies in factories, in buildings, people's homes, offices, cars, really all kinds of energy-using sectors. There are fantastic efficiency gains that can be made, adding up to many gigatons of carbon dioxide per year, but they are not being made because of the way in which the markets are not working, by dividing the cost to one party and the benefit to another party. And the best way to overcome these market failures is, again, by a form of direct regulation. Now, you just mentioned contraction and convergence, and let's just bear in mind that contraction and convergence is an approach which developed during the late 1980s and early 1990s. And at the time, I think it was the best idea around, and it seemed to fit the bill. However, the way in which it would work is ultimately through the carbon price alone in order to yield its benefits. And as such, there is a huge wasted opportunity in terms of the revenues that could be taken up from the sale of permits and actually put into the accelerated delivery of solutions.
Perhaps we can get into a little bit more detail. Looking at the allocation of resources, the sale of the pollution permits generates a fund of about $1 trillion a year. Yes. The three main ways that would be applied, as I understand it, would be adaptation for poor countries to adapt to climate change that is inevitable. And you're talking about quite a large amount there, and something which is much more sufficient than the kind of derisory amounts that have been raised so far through the Kyoto Protocol, which largely is, I mean, a couple of the funds are actually voluntary, so that they kind of rely on countries just kind of having the goodwill to put a little bit of money aside there. And you're also putting money into forest retention. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? That's your kind of solution, really, to protecting the forests, which forest degradation and ecosystem degradation is responsible for about 18% of global carbon emissions, so that's really important and is being talked about at the UN talks at the moment. But their solution is to bring it into the carbon markets, in fact, into the clean development mechanisms, which we were talking about earlier, has had such a bad record already, doesn't really bode very well. And also would, in a sense, give rich countries an even bigger excuse to continue not to decarbonise their economies at home, because the options for buying in these additional credits would become much larger. So can you say a bit about how you're proposing to protect forests?
Well, to begin with, I think that the current thinking about bringing reduced emissions from deforestation into the carbon market is completely disastrous, because we've seen the kinds of abuses that have already taken place in carbon markets with relatively straightforward industrial emissions, for example. And I think that in the case of forests, you're getting into an area of enormous complexity and with an enormous potential for abuse. And what we've seen in the carbon markets is that if there is a potential for abuse, which will produce cheap credits and high profits, then every single possibility for abuse will be exploited to the max by the project developers, and that it'll be some number of years, or perhaps more, before the loopholes are actually adequately clamped down on. And in fact, at a philosophical level, you have to say what the world needs is not to reduce developing country emissions from forests as an alternative to reducing developed country industrial emissions, which is what the carbon market process would be predicated on, we need both. So setting one off against the other is simply no solution at all. What is proposed under Kyoto 2 is that you're selling your permits and raising about $1 trillion a year, and probably a couple of $100 billion would be dedicated to preserving forests. First, you have to recognize that we are paying countries that have forests to destroy their forests and turn it into cattle ranches, palm oil plantations, soybean farms, and such like. If we are to keep these forests, we need to reverse that financial incentive. So we need to be paying those same countries more to keep their forests than the market in soybeans and palm oil and beef is paying them to destroy them. And you would do that by paying countries a kind of rent for the carbon that they have embodied in their forests. But then on top of that, you would pay and support those countries, for example, in beefing up their forestry departments to be able to do the job that you're calling upon them to do. And we also need to look at other kinds of biospheric carbon. We need to be enhancing forests, certainly, and the role that forests can play as sinks, but also we need to remember peat swamps are an enormous source of carbon dioxide and methane, especially when they're drained, as has been taking place in the tropical swamps of Indonesia. And also in soils more generally, we need to try and turn around the entire nature of agriculture so that instead of being a major net source of greenhouse gas emissions, we are reducing those emissions but also enhancing the role of soils as a place where carbon dioxide can be safely locked up in those soils. At the same time, in fact, as increasing the capacity of those soils to hold fertilizers, to retain nutrients, and to retain moisture. And in that way, you're getting a double benefit. You're bringing carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere where your carbon is a waste product, and you're putting it into soils where it's actually enriching those soils and making those soils more fertile and more capable of feeding us. So there is a double solution there.
In terms of allocating resources from this fund, there are quite a number of other bits and pieces, but the third major plank really is about bringing about a shift to a low-carbon economy, so helping especially poor countries bring in a kind of energy efficiency and kind of renewable energy supplies. Contraction and convergence also brings about a transfer of financial resources from the rich to the poor, but you're saying that it will be government-to-government transfer. So, for example, poor countries with corrupt leaders may not, A, pass those benefits on to their populations, and B, might not use them in a way which is to the best in terms of mitigating climate change.
Well, what I certainly think is that you are much better off making targeted expenditures. In the same way, for example, as the Montreal Protocols targeted its investments to reduce the emissions of CFCs, I think that we need to be targeting investments into renewables and into technologies which have the best chance of being effective. And there are huge opportunities in developed countries to bring about change. And really, I think these countries belong in two categories. One is the category of countries that have very little energy infrastructure and where energy infrastructure is being built at a slow rate. And I think there that you can say that equity demands that we bring people the benefits of access to electricity and energy generally, but that we should do it in a renewable way. And there we've got the opportunity to build whole new energy infrastructures based on renewable energy. And so that is really setting these poor countries off on a whole different development path, more or less, from the beginning. And it's important to get in there and do that before they start developing fossil fuel-based infrastructure, which is what is already happening in a number of countries where you've got, for example, quite large-scale coal development going on, because coal is quite cheap and a number of these countries have coal reserves, which understandably they want to exploit. So I think that's probably the way forward for countries that don't have much existing energy infrastructure. And then you can look at countries like China, the rapidly industrialized countries, which actually are already mobilizing considerable finance for the building of new power stations. And in China, roughly 1 gigawatt of new coal-fired capacity is being built every week. And there, we need to provide supplementary finance on top of the existing finance that is already lined up in order to switch the investment from coal-fired electrical capacity into renewable electrical capacity. And so, for example, you can pay the extra cost of developing wind power or perhaps concentrated solar power instead of coal-fired capacity. And that means that you're leveraging your investment and simply adding that to the investments that are already taking place. The other point is energy efficiency. And there's huge potential gains to be made in energy efficiency around the world. And quite a lot of these are in developing countries. But actually, too, there are huge energy efficiency needs in developed countries. And you only have to look at the state of Britain's housing stock, for example. And I think that there should be funding made available also in developed countries for energy efficiency, simply because it's in developed countries where most of the energy is being used that the greatest potential for improvements in energy efficiency exists. And we have to recognize here from an equity point of view that you can have rich countries, but you can have poor people in those rich countries who need this kind of help. And so I think that some of the money that's available should be used to contribute to energy efficiency improvements in developed countries, supplementing finance coming from existing sources such as government finance, but in particular where it's aimed at the needs of poor people.
That was Oliver Tickell, author of Kyoto 2, How to Manage the Global Greenhouse, which is published by Zed Books in the UK. And there is a further 40 minutes or so of my interview with Oliver, which will be up in a few days on the Climate Radio website at climateradio.co.uk, where we get into a little bit more detail about how the scheme works, how it would be policed, how it compares to contraction and convergence, and how it might achieve global acceptance by building on the EU emissions trading scheme and Barack Obama's US cap and trade system. You can also find out more about Kyoto 2 by visiting Oliver's website at kyoto2.org. But until next week, thanks for listening.